Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sparty Talk for Sunday, September 11, 2011. Satchmo and DB coming at you one day after Michigan State whooped Florida Atlantic. Michigan stunned Notre Dame under the lights in the Big House, and Ohio State dodged a bullet against Toledo. Before we get to all of that, let's welcome in the Thin Man, DB. What up?
Greetings, Spartan Nation. Great to be with you after a 44-zip dismantling of our gracious house guest, Howard Schellenberger.
It is always great to be on the air after the Schellenberger comes to town. But before we get into all of that, as most of you know, today is the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. So if you don't mind, DB, I'm going to go Ken Beatrice on you and beg your indulgence for a moment. Well, it's more like 30 seconds. Yeah, it's more like 30 seconds to address the topic. And if you guys don't want me to listen to the following 30 seconds, just go ahead and skip ahead on the podcast. But, DB, as you know, this is something near and dear to my heart. On this day 10 years ago, I watched American Airlines Flight 77 crash into the Pentagon, killing all 64 aboard. To the people who lost loved ones on that plane, I'm sorry. The plane exploded on impact. We had no chance to help. To the people who lost loved ones in the 9/11 attacks, I stand in solidarity with you. To the brave first responders in New York who went up when anyone else would have gone down, you are what makes America great. To the incredible members of our military who have unfairly shouldered the grief of a nation and hunted down the perpetrators of these attacks, thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your sacrifice. And to the bastards that attacked us on 9/11, I hope you all rot in hell. All right, that's it for the political science PSA section of the show. You ready to talk football, Davey, or do you have something to add?
Well, I just wanted to echo that, too, because I think it's important that we do just take a minute. And I couldn't say it better than you did. That was very thoughtful. I think the one thing to remember, especially on this day, because I know a lot of Americans that lived through that time, including myself, will never forget that. But at the same time, I don't think anyone wants to, you know, unless they're completely nuts, wants to relive that time again. But I think it's important that we always keep especially the victims' memories in our mind and the families that lost loved ones. And, if you have a few moments today, time to reflect amid all the NFL watching or whatever you're doing, take a few minutes and remember.
And I have to take a few minutes to remember. And if you happen to turn on the CNN, if you hear Wolf Blitzer, just change the channel, because he shouldn't be inflicted on you. All right, let's turn to the Michigan State Florida Atlantic game now, where Howard Schellenberger realized that being a good death means never challenging the team that's giving you a big payout, unlike we did last year. I thought you turtled up from the beginning, DB, as the Spartans rolled to a 44-0 victory. Michigan State yielded just one first down, which tied a school record, and gave up only 48 yards, which didn't come close to breaking a school record. So, DB, are the Spartans as good as they looked this week, as bad as they looked last week, or somewhere in between?
Well, that's a great question. And I see our good friend, Drew Sharp, in the Detroit Free Press.
You won't hear from Wolf Blitzer, by the way. Go ahead.
What, good friend, or...
I know, a great question.
Right, yeah. Well, you can't get much out of Wolf. It's somewhere in between to me. Now, I'll accentuate the positive, because as you know, I always try to be positive on this podcast. The defense in particular could have laid an egg yesterday and let Florida Atlantic run all over the field on them, but they didn't. They came prepared. They came ready to play. On the other hand, Satchwell, this is a question back to you. It's rhetorical in some ways, but feel free to respond. Did Florida Atlantic make us look better, especially on defense, than maybe we are?
Absolutely. I mean, let's consider the evidence. Florida Atlantic had one first down.
That's
first down. A Michigan, terrible. a Michigan State defense hadn't done that, I think, since 1944 against Maryland.
Wow.
I mean, that's just unbelievable. And for those of you wondering, DB, do you know the record for fewest yards allowed by a Michigan State team?
23?
No. Minus 11.
Wow.
Minus 11. And it came in 1950 against Pitt.
Wow.
Little Spartan football trivia there for you boys and girls this morning. Florida Atlantic made the Michigan State defense look really well. Look, the Florida Atlantic quarterback couldn't hit the Atlantic Ocean if he was pissing it from 20 yards away or from 5 feet away. I mean, it was horrendous. It was a horrendous display of offense. Michigan State got a couple sacks in this game. They only got two. But it's not like, you know, the FAU quarterback was running for his life. He just sucked. There's no other way to put it. And I feel bad for a kid because you don't want to go, you don't want to spend your time killing a college quarterback or killing a college
that's an ugly game schedule, and it's always obviously more fun to be on the other side of that. But we, as Spartans, and other teams have felt this too, it's no fun at all to be on the other side of that as fans or players.
No, as fans or players, Florida Atlantic opened up the season against Florida, which couldn't have done wonders for their psyche. Now, then they went and got pounded by Michigan State. I think they play another really good team next week, too. It's just a murderer's row, but, they're getting paid for it, and so there you go. But they were just bad. The Florida Atlantic offensive line was incapable of opening up holes, and therefore, they couldn't run the ball. I mean, they had some open receivers that the quarterback just missed. It was not a good outing by Florida Atlantic. Did Michigan State play well? Yes. Their defense played with a sense of urgency? Yes. They played with more of a sense of urgency than they did last week against Youngstown State. Were they aided by the fact that Michigan State controlled the ball on offense and was moving the ball effectively on offense? Yes. That helped a great deal as well. So there were a lot of factors involved with that. And so overall it was a good performance. But I don't think this is a measuring stick of any sort whatsoever.
No.
Simply because the offense was never challenged. I mean, you take a look at a couple of the passes in particular in yesterday's game. B.J. Cunningham's first circus catch to set the record for most receptions by a Michigan State player. It wasn't the best throw ball by Cousins, and B.J. Cunningham's bobbling it, and Florida Atlantic just sort of let him do that. And against better football teams, someone's going to plant B.J. Cunningham. That ball is going to be incomplete or picked off. And there was a touchdown pass where it looked like a Florida Atlantic player zipped in front of the Michigan State tight end. I think it was Selleck. And just missed picking it off. And that was by virtue of Cousins having a good arm and by the Florida Atlantic players not being quite as good as players you'll see at another team. And against another team, I think that turns into an interception, and that's a scoring opportunity loss. So there's plenty of room to work on. It's good. DB, were you impressed with the offensive line in this game? Because they seemed to give up some quarterback pressures. They didn't seem to open up great holes in the running game. I mean, Michigan State did well from a rushing standpoint. They had 188 yards rushing. But on the other hand, it didn't seem to be a dominant rushing performance. Did it feel that way to you, DB?
Well, dominant is not the word. I think definitely a little bit better than last week against Youngstown State. I think it's a work in progress, though. I think Coach D'Antonio and the offensive line coach and the offensive coordinator at Michigan State know that it's going to be some lumps, especially early on. What I liked about the offensive line a little bit more today, yesterday, even though it wasn't perfect, was that we were able to run the ball a little bit more effectively, not just to one side. On the other hand, I saw moments when the running backs were trying to, the holes really weren't there yet. And I think that's just still something that needs to be worked on. I hear you on the quarterback pressures, and here's one thing I look at with that, and you can see the difference when Cousins and Maxwell are in the game, and I don't want to steal the thunder to go ahead, but this does relate to the offensive line. Kirk Cousins has more poise back there because of his experience, and he knows when the pressure is coming, and he knows it's going to come because that offensive line is, you know, quite young, and he's able to get rid of the ball quickly. Andrew Maxwell, by comparison, in some ways can't handle that. He's kind of running around trying to do too much back there, Stachmo. Do you see where I'm going with this, or am I kind of off
base? Yeah, no, I see where you're going with this. Look, there is no such thing as a perfect pocket this year for the Michigan State offensive line. I mean, Cousins has to get back there and get the ball out quickly, and you can tell he knows how to do that. I mean, he gets back up, he gets out there, he goes through his reads quickly, and that ball's coming out. Whereas with Maxwell, he's still learning the offense. And it shows. I mean, he goes back there. He's not necessarily sure where to go with the ball every time. And that rush gets to him, and he ends up running around, you know, spending time avoiding the rush and looking for a receiver downfield. And it's what you expect out of a senior quarterback in Cousins, though. But for everyone that was, and you guys are all doofuses for doing this, wanting to see more Maxwell and less Cousins, we've got a couple of doofus friends, Stevie. But it's one of those things where you begin to appreciate, and I think that's the hard thing for Spartan fans, because we haven't had that many blowouts. You don't see much of Maxwell, and when you do see him, you're like, oh wow, the guy's got a live arm and he's pretty good. But it's hard to appreciate how raw he is until you get an extended look at him, like Michigan State had an extended look at him yesterday. And it makes you realize that, you want to know what? Next year, Michigan State's really going to miss Kirk Cousins. I mean, they're going to miss him a lot. Maxwell's going to be a good quarterback, but Kirk Cousins is an NFL-caliber quarterback who's been playing at a very high level for the last 2 or 3 years. And I think it's time Spartan fans really appreciate Kirk Cousins and what he does, rather than just yelling at him for throwing off his back foot occasionally.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the Cousins haters need to stop. First of all, Cousins is the quarterback, so enough said. And the Spartans would be lost without Kirk Cousins. The other thing is, I like Andrew Maxwell. He's got a good arm. He needs to work on some things. But you know what's great, Satchmo, is? And I'm jumping ahead again. This is a good segue. Andrew Maxwell got some work yesterday. And Mark D'Antonio put him into the game, got some live fire. A lot of players, 70 players, I believe I read, got playing time, which is great. And the great thing about Maxwell is that he was able to get into the game. And, you know, that's a great thing for him, because the coaches can take him back, look at the game film and say, hey, look, this is what you got to work on. This is what you're doing well, so on and so forth. And next year, if I just jump ahead for a second, when we get to spring ball, he's going to be the guy. So there's going to be, right off the bat, he's got a great tutor in Cousins, and he's going to be the guy right off the bat, Satchmo.
Yeah, he's going to be the guy right off the bat. He's had a great tutor. He understands the offense. He understands the basic principles. He's been working with these receivers for a while. Obviously, you won't have Cunningham and Nickel to throw the ball to, which is going to make things interesting. He's going to be throwing the ball to Tony Lippett and some new receivers, some freshmen. Keyshawn Martin won't be there either. He's going to have a new set of receivers, and the headliner is going to be Tony Lippett, and Benny Fowler will be the other big receiver. And you're going to have some young kids coming up behind him and throwing the ball, so you could see the future. I like the idea of the Michigan State coaching staff making sure Maxwell gets some work this year. He didn't get much work last year because there weren't that many blowouts. And rather than waiting for the blowout to ensue, get him in a series in the second quarter. Get him in a series here and there. When Michigan State plays Indiana, when Michigan State plays Illinois, teams that Michigan State should be beating, go ahead and get him in the game for a series in the first half before it becomes a blowout. And get him some work.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the Michigan State offense goes nowhere under him, this is important. important experience, important live fire experience for them. That's good. That's good for the long term health of the program, and get him all that experience. He needs it. It's important. And as long as he's doing that, as long as D'Antonio's got that in the long term game plan, I think Michigan State fans should be really happy.
And Satchmo, just one more thing. Yesterday, it was very important, and I think Mark D'Antonio knows this. He has to look ahead a little bit. It was very important for Maxwell to get in yesterday, because when you look through the rest of the schedule, even that Central Michigan game, there aren't any gimmies on that schedule. I mean, okay, Minnesota, and I'll give them that, and I feel like they should take care of business against Central Michigan. But honestly, the only one I could see being a blowout for the Spartans, in the Spartans' favor, going the rest of the way, is the Minnesota game. That's it. Even Indiana, Satchmo, and I'm jumping around a little bit here, I watched them play last night a little bit against Virginia. Indiana's pretty slippery on offense. I mean, they don't have all the tools and weapons there. They go with this crazy no-huddle thing. And granted, they were playing Virginia, but still, they're going to catch some people off guard with that this year.
Yeah, they are. But that's my point. Is there are no gimmies, but even in the no gimmies, there are a couple of games on the schedule where you can get them in.
Yeah,
and I think they have to be mindful to do it. That's why I was actually happy, because you want to know what? There's no guarantee Cousins is going to last the entire season. Not with the way this offensive line is protected. And
right.
If Cousins gets hurt, Maxwell's your guy, because we sure don't want Peter Badanovich doing it.
Well, by the way, isn't Peter Badanovich a movie director?
Or Badanovich? Yeah, movie director. Absolutely.
Badanovich is what I'm thinking of. There really is a guy with that name, though. It's a Hollywood screenwriter or something. Anyway.
And look, it was good to see Badanovich get in the game. I was happy. I was shocked because I didn't know he was on the roster, but I was happy. It's one of those things where it's like, all right, we do have a third-string quarterback, and it's Peter Badanovich. But it was good to see him get in the game. Happy for the kid. Happy to know Michigan State has a third-string quarterback beyond Keith Pitbull. All of that and Keyshawn Martin. All of that stuff is good. So in that sense, it was good. But, yeah, I think getting Maxwell in there is a huge part of this, because who knows whether he's going to stay upright. All right, Le'Veon Bell, Edwin Baker, Larry Caper. All three had their chances. Larry Caper did put the ball on the ground once, which is unusual because he's widely considered to have the best hands of the group. Michigan State did recover that fumble. It was their only Notre Dame-esque moment of the day. But it was... there'll be more shots at Notre Dame throughout the program. Don't you worry.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there, and Le'Veon Bell had the classic video game moment where it looked like you're hitting the button, and he does the spin move. You hit another button, and he throws the stiff arm. And that was fun to see. But it looked to me, DB, like it was the efforts of the running backs and the fullback, actually, who threw some nice blocks that really generated the yards, and not so much the offensive line.
Right.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. Continue with your thought. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, in that set, it strikes me in situations like that, Le'Veon Bell is actually probably the running back best suited for that sort of running attack. I think Edwin Baker, if there's a hole, he's going to find it, and he's going to bust through and pick up yards.
Yeah. Agreed.
That's just the way Edwin Baker is. If there's a hole, he'll find it and run through it. Le'Veon Bell, if there's no hole, he still manages to find yards. It was like that in the touchdown carry he had. There wasn't a real hole there. He just sort of found a little crack in a seam and burrowed his way through it. And you saw the spin move, the stiff arm to get open, and he's a big, powerful runner and sort of turns his legs and is very good at that way. And Larry Caper doesn't seem to be as good without the hole there, and, you know, very few running backs are good without a hole, but Le'Veon Bell struck me as the one running back behind this offensive line, who, if the offensive line doesn't have it going, he can still pick up yards. I think that's a pretty important discovery.
Yeah, well, I mentioned last week, Satchmo, that I was particularly impressed with, you know, not taking nothing away from Baker, who's a great running back. I was very impressed last week with the physical conditioning of Bell and Caper. They both look a bit bulkier than last year, especially Bell. And you're exactly right about Bell. And you know what I also liked, Satchmo, speaking of the running backs, great to see Nick Hill get in the game. And I love his speed. He's going to be something else to watch as he progresses.
Yeah, he's got some quicks. And he's got some quicks that the other backs don't have. He's got that sort of home run speed where if he breaks a tackle, he's gone. And you can't really say that about the other guys. I mean, those guys are fast and powerful. But Nick Hill's got some serious quicks. And you can see why there's some excitement about him as a kick returner. He's got some tools out there.
Is this the best? I'm not calling these guys the best running backs ever at Michigan State. That would be doing a great disservice to the great running backs we've had, which we know who they are, Spartan Nation knows. But is this the best group of running backs that we've ever had at one time? I can't remember a time where we've had this many, three, potentially four, good running backs in the same backfield at one time for Michigan State.
Yeah, I mean, Michigan State was typically a team that had two good running backs. And you just rotated between in and out, and they just wore you down. But you're right. This is easily, from a depth standpoint, this is the deepest that Michigan State's ever been at running back. Now, I don't think any one of these guys rises to the level of Lorenzo White or anything like that. They're not as good as he was, but as a group, this group is deeper, faster, and better than any other group of Michigan State running backs. I mean, when you take a look at, I mean, you got Alonzo Highsmith, Lorenzo White,
Tico Duckett,
T.J. Duckett. I mean, I don't see any one of them being better than T.J. Duckett. I don't see any one of them being better than Lorenzo White. I don't see any one of them being better than Alonzo Highsmith. I do see him being better than Tico Duckett. I will say that. Or at least equal to Tico Duckett, if not better.
I can see that.
But I wouldn't say this is any one of these guys is the most talented. I do agree, as a group, it's the most talented group. There's not a whole lot of drop-off from one to the other as you bring them out. And from that standpoint, I think it's impressive because Michigan State always has on the field a significant running attack or a significant running threat. Not necessarily running attack, but a significant running threat because all of these guys are outstanding. They'd all be starting for almost any Division I program out there. And so you can't go to sleep when you're playing defense on the Michigan State rushing game because these guys are that good. And I think that's a pretty big deal.
Yep. Hey, Satchmo, cheap plug here, because you mentioned yesterday on our Twitter feed, by the way, folks, we have a Twitter handle. It is at Sparty Talk, correct, Satchmo?
Yep, at Sparty Talk.
Yep, and then, by the way, you're listening to Sparty Talk on blogtalkradio.com, and we come your way every week, typically every Sunday after a Saturday game, but as it were. But anyway, one of the things you mentioned on the Twitter feed, Satchmo, I believe, or you may have said it on a previous podcast, was that any of those running backs could start on any team.
Yeah, they really could. They all have excellent speed. They all have excellent top-line speed. They all have great hands. They all do a good job of bursting through the hole with some explosiveness. All have good moves, all good at picking up the blocks. It's really a collection of running backs to be envied. There isn't a team out there. You look at Alabama, you look at Penn State. Penn State would love to have one of these running backs. It would have made their life a lot easier against Alabama yesterday. I mean, Notre Dame, oh, yeah. Any of these guys would start ahead of the Notre Dame running back, who is decent, but not as good as these guys. Doesn't quite have the power that these guys have. Has some of the speed, but none of the moves. Doesn't identify the holes as well. I mean, these are really good running backs. They've been coached up well. They've done an excellent job of recruiting these guys here, and it's a remarkable collection. And when you throw in the fact that on top of these excellent running backs, you can run Keyshawn Martin out of the backfield in reverses, and you can run Tony Liffin out of the backfield in reverses. You've got a very diversified rushing attack that's pretty remarkable. And your only wish is you had an offensive line that matched excellence of the running backs.
Yeah.
These guys would be incredible if they had holes to run through.
Seth, well, I wanted to switch gears briefly over to the special teams because I know you had some issues, and I think Mark D'Antonio, you channeled him or something, because Dan Conroy, Satchmo, was kind of interesting yesterday. He hit a 50-yarder, I believe, but then missed, what, two?
No, he only missed one.
He
missed a chip shot. He just pulled it and didn't look good. And that's the second chip shot Conroy's missed this season. Now, last week they blamed the chip shot on a bad hold. Sontag apparently didn't turn the laces. And whenever you don't turn the laces, you're going to get a bad kick. But even when you don't turn the laces and get a bad kick, it shouldn't have been as bad as the kick as it was last week. I mean, that was just awful. And then yet another missed short field goal this week. And that's why you saw Muma out there kicking a field goal. Muma wasn't out there kicking a field goal just because it was a 28-yard field goal, which he snuck in the uprights. It wasn't like it went right down the middle or anything like that. But Muma wasn't just out there kicking a field goal because D'Antonio wanted to see whether Muma could kick a field goal during a live game. D'Antonio was sending Conroy a message. And the message is, I don't care if you make a 50-yarder. I want you to hit everything 45 yards and in. And if you can't do that, we're going to try the other kid out and see if he can.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal because...
Full disclosure here. Satchmo is in the corner of one Kevin Muma because he's from his alma mater, Troy High School. Right?
Oh, yeah, he is a Troy High grad. that is true. And just like I root for Spartans, I root for Troy High grad. 20th reunion coming up this year, later this year.
Oh, boy. Get your bell bottoms out. I'm sorry. I don't even know why I say that. It's only the 90s. I'm sorry. Pardon me.
That's all right. I'm going to cruise in there with a CNC Music Factory play, you know, loud of the speakers on the car.
Get your flannel out.
Get your flannel out.
Sorry, I was thinking of Nirvana. You know, anyways, let's get off that.
Anyway. It is an issue for Conroy in that this is two straight games in which he's missed relative chip shots. And when you've got a football game, you've got close football games. Michigan State's going to play a lot of close football games. The difference between winning and losing is often a missed field goal. Just ask Toledo or Utah what missing a field goal is going to do to your offense and how it's going to affect the game. It costs Utah a game. It cost Toledo a shot at an upset. If Toledo hadn't missed a field goal earlier, they might have had a chance to take a field goal to win the game. Instead, they lost. It dramatically changes the game. And D'Antonio's sitting there sideline going, you want to know what? This is an issue. Two straight games, they've got to get this addressed. Because you can't go through an entire season where you're missing a field goal game. That just doesn't cut it deep.
No. Not at all. But the nice thing is, though, we have an option there. We're not just stuck with one guy. And Kevin Muma shows me some legs, Satchmo.
Yeah, he does. Well, he's been the kickoff specialist, so you know he can kick it hard. And you know he can kick it far. The question is whether he can show any consistency kicking field goals. And I've got a feeling that if Conroy continues to struggle, you're going to see D'Antonio give Muma a shot. Let's face it. I mean, when it comes to kickers, coaches aren't the most patient souls in the world.
No, they're kind of like goaltenders in a lot of ways.
Yeah, they're kind of like goaltenders in a lot of ways. You know, the quarterback, if he's struggling, they're going to stick with him. But if the kicker's struggling, that hope's coming out faster than it does at the Apollo.
I'm digressing a bit for a moment, Dad, but I remember a few times early on in the Nick Saban tenure at the Spartans of some headphones just being tossed on the ground when Chris Gardner couldn't hit a chip shot field goal.
Yes.
Saban just waving his hand. And there was, in fact, there's a game that sticks in my memory, and I don't know why, but it was a chance to beat Penn State in State College on a field goal, and I think it was like a 35-yarder. I mean, it wasn't really long. And I just remember Gardner just completely shanked it to the right or something, and Saban just, like, whipped his headphones down and just, like, turned his back. I was like, God, whatever, forget this.
I think, you know, the beauty of Saban, and this is the area where I think Saban has changed a lot over the years. When he was at East Lansing, he was one of the most expressive coaches I've ever seen on the sideline. Now he does a pretty good job of keeping his emotions in check on the sideline, but it was great. I mean, you know what, Chip Kelly or Brian Kelly? You know what, Brian Kelly just lost it on the sideline.
Oh yeah, Brian. Well, we'll talk about this in a minute, Satchmo, because we're going to get to it. But Brian Kelly is very expressive. Yes.
Brian Kelly's ready. Brian Kelly looks like a pressure cooker on the sideline. His gasket is getting ready to explode.
You know who
was pretty expressive.
You know who Kelly reminds me of on the sideline in a lot of ways is Tom Izzo. I would not want to feel Kelly's wrath when I come back to the sideline.
Am I right about that?
I mean, Tom Izzo is not a guy you want to tick off if you do something stupid out there, right?
Yeah, no. Not a guy you want to tick off, definitely. Let's wrap up the special team song. Mike Sadler only had one punt. Put it inside the 20. But DB, I don't know what we have in Mike Sadler. But we might find out next week if Antonio calls another big field goal.
Yeah, we Well, the real question with Mike Sadler is what kind of arm does he have?
Can he hit the tight end in the flat? That's what we want to know about Mike Sadler.
Yeah, they're going to call it Jesus Giants next week if we hit that.
All right. Let's wrap up the discussion in the Michigan State Florida Atlantic game with one Howard Schellenberger. He is retiring.
Yes.
We will not see the likes of Howard Schellenberger on the Spartan sidelines again. And let us begin, and we will discuss his coaching, because I think it is worth noting that he is a legendary college football coach, so we'll address that in a moment. But first, we have to note his sartorial splendor on the sidelines. DB, a fashion report, please.
Oh, well, first of all, and Satchmo, we've talked about this, Howard Schellenberger, who, by the way, Satchmo is very afraid of, I think.
Absolutely.
I think Satchmo is next to... You know, I don't know. We'll get into a deeper – we'll examine Satchmo's psyche some other day on the podcast. But I think Howard Schellenberger, maybe Minnesota Gopher Steel is the other thing Satchmo's also very afraid of. But
you must fear the Schellenberger.
You must fear the Schellenberger. He is the most well-dressed college coach I've ever seen. He wears, if I'm not mistaken, that looks like a three-piece suit he wears out there. Am I right or pretty close to it?
You are correct. You are correct.
Yeah.
Sometimes he drops the vest, but those are dapper-looking suits he wears.
He is outstandingly professionally dressed. Look like he's ready to lead the company to the best year ever every time he's out there on the field. And the great thing yesterday that I noticed, there was a couple of add-ons. First of all, the Florida Atlantic Owl red-colored suspenders that he had on underneath that suit were very shiny and impressive, Satchmo.
Those were fantastic. Those may be ones that you want to go out and buy, like, green suspenders. I mean, I'm thinking about it now. I'm thinking about whether I can pull off this look for the Ohio State game, DB. Show up with the fedora and the green suspenders and the suit coat and the whole thing.
Right. Green suspenders with a white MSU shirt. Yeah, I think you'd be rocking. But then here's another thing, too. Satchmo yesterday, and I've never seen him do this. Maybe he was just trying to change the owl's look, but I saw him don a baseball cap, which looked way out of place in the second half of the game. Did you catch that, Satchmo?
Yeah, I saw the baseball hat, and somehow he managed to make it work. It looked out of place, but at the same time, you're like, yeah, I'm feeling that. I mean, go ahead, DB.
No, it looked like he just got off work and was going to watch his son's T-ball game.
Yeah, this is a guy that
has
this amazing ability to make clothes work for him. I mean, on the one side, like, we've got D'Antonio wearing the polo shirt and the khakis, looking like a college football coach. Like a typical college coach. And then you had Howard Schnellenberg, and he was Mr. GQ over there. And you just had to admire the look. You know, it was almost like he came from an era, and I guess he did, where you dressed up the fly. And you dressed up to go on Sunday drives, and he was dressed up for the game, and he looked like the Civil War general that you were following the battle. It was fantastic. I love the quote. And he's always dressed like that.
He's a legend, Satchmo. I'll miss him, and I'll say this: there won't be a lot like him. And also, I guess Mark D'Antonio gave him a game ball yesterday after the game.
Yes, he did give him a game ball. I thought that was a classy gesture. It's Schnellenberg's last season on the sidelines. And for those of you that don't know about Schnellenberger, back in the 70s and the early 80s, he brought speed to college football. The SEC likes to think that they brought speed to college football. That's what I like to call revisionist history. Howard Schnellenberger brought speed to college football. Howard Schnellenberger realized that if you were faster at every position than anyone else, you were going to win a lot of football games. Won national championships at Miami. He redefined the way college football was played. His receivers were faster, and his running backs were faster, his defensive players were faster. And because they were faster, they ran hard, they hit hard, they got to the ball first. You saw swarming defenses, great man-to-man coverage, great zone coverage, whatever it was. He could dial up any play he wanted to, and you knew it would work because his guys were faster than your guys. He went to a private school down in Miami that no one – there was no football tradition at the University of Miami. Everyone talks about the U, all right? You want to know what? There was no the U before Howard Schnellenberg.
Right.
And he changed college football strategy. He changed college football recruiting. He changed the culture of college football. This is a man that deserves to be remembered as one of the legends of the game. And I hope people understood what they were watching on the sideline yesterday as he coached out his final game.
Yeah. Satchmo, one question about Schnellenberger. Was he at Oklahoma also at one time, or am I just imagining that?
No, I think he was.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was before Switzer. I think he spent a little time there.
Satchmo, I don't know if you have any more to say about Schnellenberg. I have two other just quick notes and a question about yesterday's game. We won't take too long on the question. Just one other thing that I noticed. Speaking of legends, and yes, I fully agree about Howard Schnellenberger, and I'll miss him roaming the sideline for Florida Atlantic. They don't make him like him anymore, like him and Joe Pa. Earl Morrill. The legendary, one of the all-time great MSU and NFL quarterbacks. And Earl Morrill, by the way, could do so many things in the NFL. I read some trivia the other day that in the 1950s, shortly after he was drafted into the NFL and graduated from Michigan State by the San Francisco 49ers, he punted a little bit as well because they already had a quarterback. And so Morrill was just so multi-purpose. And back in those days, a lot of quarterbacks and punters and other players to do different things. But Morrill was at the game yesterday, and Mark Hollis's box watching the game and had some nice things to say about the Spartans and Kirk Cousins. And Morrill, being a former Detroit Lion, also had a couple of nice comments directed at the Lions quarterback, hopefully legend in waiting, Matthew Stafford.
Yeah, so we will get to the Lions in a moment, because I think it's worth talking about. It was nice to see Earl Morrall back in Spartan Stadium.
And one question, and Satchel, we had a little debate about this at the beginning, and we won't spend a long time on this, but one thing I noticed is finally, last week, just to recap, or going back into the summer, there was a concert at Spartan Stadium with U2, big concert, and the grass, as they expected, got a little bit messed up, as it does from those rock concerts. And they had to install new sod on the field, and it looked wonderful for the opening game. But one thing that Satchmo and I noticed from being in attendance at the first game was there was no block S at midfield. And we had found out later that they didn't want to put any heavy paint yet on the new turf, so they left it off. Yesterday, when we tuned in, lo and behold, there was something in midfield, but it wasn't the block S. Those had been moved over between the 25 and 30-yard lines on either end of the field. And the ginormous Sparty, which looked excellent, donned the middle of the field. And, Satchmo, what was your thought about seeing the ginormous Sparty, which is also on our football helmets and other MSU paraphernalia, on at the 50?
Yeah, I didn't like it. Get the block S back.
Yeah.
The block S
is
Michigan State. It just is. You see the block S, you know it's Michigan State. Put the block S on the field at the 50-yard line.
Here, I agree to some extent. Here's what I think. The block S has always been there at the center of the court in basketball, at center ice in hockey, at midfield in football, you know, some of the other sports we play. Here's my thing. I love the Sparty. I love it on the helmet. I have no problem with that. I agree. Put the Sparties in the end zone next to the word Spartans. That's fine. Brand that up all you want. Leave the block S at midfield. That's what I say. But my thing with Michigan State is, forever and ever they've had the block S there. Stick with it. That's the thing about Michigan State Athletic Department that kind of annoys me a little bit. They don't ever stick with one thing. They're always changing it too much. And I know all these college teams, they're all sort of hitched to the branding here with the Nike and everybody else. Nike's Michigan State sponsor. And we'll get to the hideousness of Notre Dame and Michigan's uniforms in a second, last night by Adidas.
Yeah.
But stick with one thing and keep going with it. Leave the Sparties on the helmets. Leave the block S at midfield. That's my take.
Yeah. And you want to know what, just to give you an idea of how recognizable the block S is. If I wear Michigan State gear with a Sparty on it, and you've got people who aren't from the Midwest, some of them think I'm actually wearing a USC Trojan shirt.
Yeah,
because it's identified, that helmet and the whole, the plume and the whole thing is identified with USC. It's identified with the Cajuns. You want to know what's identified with Michigan State? The block S.
Yeah.
You put that block S on, everyone knows Michigan State.
It's interesting that you just said that, though, because the Michigan State Athletic Department views it the other way. They think that the Sparty is more nationally recognized and that the block S is only Midwest or Michigan recognized.
You want to know what? If they spend some time traveling the country like I do, if you go out to Vegas, if you go out to California, if you spend some time out there, if you go out to like Budapest or you go to London or anything like that, and people look at it, they instantly look at the Sparty and think USC, whereas when I wear my block S gear, it's like Michigan State. Boom. They know it.
Yeah.
They know
anyway,
it.
Debate for another.
These guys don't leave the state of Michigan.
Yeah. Debate for another day. We'll save that for the bye week. But anyway, we got a few games to talk about, including our opponent for next week, I suppose.
Yeah. Let's shift gears to Notre Dame. For the second straight week, Notre Dame found a unique way to lose.
Part of me felt bad for the Irish, and I don't often feel bad for the Irish that well, but part of me just felt I could feel their pain.
Oh my goodness! Well, this is Notre Dame lost 35-31 to the University of Michigan, and let us open this discussion by saying we dislike both teams intensely. If the field had opened up and swallowed both teams and not spit them out, we would have been okay with it.
Agreed.
Agreed. But it didn't. And given that it didn't, I think it's okay to say this, that and we have to give Michael Rosenberg credit for it. The Thomas Edison Classic was an interesting game to watch.
The Thomas Edison Classic, I love it.
Yes.
Let there be light.
If you go back to the Spartan Talk Twitter feed, you will see that we used the hashtag Thomas Edison Classic throughout the night describing this game. But the big house did look cool under the light. So I will say that. And all the yellow jerseys and pom-poms under the light, it did look very impressive. And it's the first time I can remember the big house actually having sound. And so that was also interesting as well. All of that was good. But the football on display there, Notre Dame was the better team throughout the entire game. They moved the ball at will until they got into the red zone, where they, threw two interceptions and fumbled it three times. Five turnovers, DB. Four turnovers in their first game against South Florida. Nine turnovers in two games. And these are your run-of-the-mill turnovers. These are the quarterback, trying to throw a pass and just flat out dropping the ball. These are running backs who are barely being hit and coughing the ball up. I mean, they put up 513 yards. They could have had 80 points yesterday if they didn't turn the ball over, DB.
Well, that's interesting too, Satchmo. And looking at Notre Dame's offense for a second here, I find it interesting when the broadcasters, and Musburger said this, and that silly dweeb Kirk Herbstreit, who I no longer like, sitting there saying, what poise Tommy Reeves has in the pocket. Boy, they must think a lot of him. Boy, they must really think a lot of him because they named Dane Chris the starter at the beginning of the year. I mean, I think that's the biggest problem right there. Brian Kelly's playing musical quarterbacks here. I don't think the man really understands what he's got on offense yet. And I don't think that's totally his fault because he inherited some of those guys. But he did recruit Reeves and Chris. I believe they're both sophomores. Am I right about that?
But,
or are one of those
guys
Charlie White's guy?
You got to give Reeves credit. I mean, the guy was marching the team up and down the field. I mean, outside of his one fumble, he didn't make that many mistakes. I mean, he threw two interceptions.
No, he
didn't. Threw three.
I'm not ripping Reed. I'm just questioning Brian Kelly's judgment here a little bit. I mean, why wasn't Reed the starter? That's all I'm saying. I mean, why wasn't Reed the starter to begin with? That's all. I'm sure Notre Dame fans are asking the same question.
Well, because they remember Chris throwing for 450 yards against Michigan State last year. They're like, we want that guy. But you're right.
Yeah.
I agree he should have been the starter the entire way. But this is unbelievable. Notre Dame should have won both games by 30 points.
Well,
Denard Robinson completed 11 passes to Michigan and three passes to Notre Dame yesterday.
Yeah, he's not really a great dropback passer.
No, Denard Robinson will go back and throw the ball up in the air. And you want to know what? Watching Notre Dame's defensive backs play defense, I mean, watching them play, it reminded me of when the John Elway era or the first year of the D'Antonio era, where we would be sitting there in the stands screaming at the secondary, going, look for the ball, turn around, look for the ball, look for the ball.
Yes, that's well. I had the same exact cold feeling when I was watching that too. It was a flashback to the John L. era, and that Notre Dame defense, they were outscored 28-7 in the fourth quarter. Their defense did a disappearing act in the fourth quarter. That's more. I guess my question is, I'm going to advance this ahead a little bit. Does that Notre Dame performance last night bode a little bit better for the Spartans next week?
No, because they're not that bad. I mean, this is a team that had the ball for 37 minutes. 37 minutes, DB. They had 198 yards rushing. They had 513 total yards. They had the same in the first game. You want to know what? Here's the bottom line. If Notre Dame doesn't turn the ball over, And it's not like the other team was forcing the turnovers. This was Notre Dame shooting itself in the foot. If Notre Dame can figure out a way to pull the gun out of their mouth, they're going to score 60 points a game.
Yeah.
That's just unbelievable. It doesn't bode well for anything. No. I mean, what it does is what happens, you want to know what this loss does, is if Notre Dame happens to beat Michigan State, it allows Lou Holtz to go on TV and say, see, I told you so. All of you guys were overreacting, and Notre Dame's going to go 10-2 and go to a BCS game. Notre Dame is a good football team that somehow, I mean, this is almost, Reese went 27 for 39.
Yeah.
I just don't understand that. I mean, to me, the big question I had is, Notre Dame, why did you stop running the ball for large stretches of the game?
Yeah.
33 carries, 6 yards a carry, 198 yards. There were times where you threw the ball 5, 6, 7 times in a row. I'm going, yeah, you want to know what? You guys are getting a lot of yards every carry. Why don't you try that? Huh?
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and try that?
Definitely question the judgment. The one thing I will say about that, and this is kind of directed back at Michigan, just to comment on them for a couple minutes. First of all, Denard Robinson didn't play very well, but he did play well when it mattered at the end, and he was hitting his guys, and he made some great passes. Some of that, of course, is Notre Dame. You know, that's inexcusable to have a 24-7 lead, even 24-14. You got to put that away. Your offense has to run the ball more, kill the clock. Your defense has to make the stop special. So all the way around, that was bad. And the bad thing for the Spartans is Brian Kelly's too good of a coach to not let that, you know, get corrected. They're going to be, you know, even more conservative, and you know they're going to really hang on to that ball next week even more. You may see their turnover ratio down to nothing next week I'm sure.
But the two teams scored 3 touchdowns in the final minute 11. And the reason they scored 2 touchdowns in the final minute 11 is because apparently neither team recognized that you have to guard someone when they go on down the field.
Yeah.
I mean, that big play with 30 seconds left, Denard Robinson drops back. I mean, his best play the entire game was throwing the ball as high as he could and letting his receivers figure out how to catch it, because Notre Dame sure as heck wasn't going to do it. And Notre Dame did one better on that play. They just didn't bother to guard the guy.
Well, I'm just seeing the replay right now as we're talking. And that play where Robinson hits that receiver over the middle at the 50-yard line and Notre Dame was in that Hail Mary defense, wow, that was really bad. Somebody needed to be right there to stop that guy when he was at midfield. You know, and now the one thing I'll say about we got to get off Notre Dame here in a second, but the one thing I'll say in Notre Dame's defense about not running the ball as much, I can see where their offensive coordinator saw Michigan's secondary is still very sketchy, and Michigan's defensive line has improved a great deal. So I could see where Michigan was really clamping down on the run on Notre Dame in the second half. They were doing a pretty good job. But still, you're right. You got to find a way to run that ball. I mean, Notre Dame's got a mammoth offensive line. They're pretty good. And, you know, that's going to be problematic for our defensive line next week, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the great fear, we'll wrap it up on this note with Notre Dame, the great fear of Michigan State is that offense looks very difficult to stop. That offense, if you take away the turnovers, and I know you can't really do that, but you should. If you take away the turnovers, that offense has put up 70 points and 70 points in the first two games. That is a dynamic, prolific offense. Michael Floyd is a fantastic wide receiver. Michael Floyd is basically this year's Plaxico Burress. That's how good he is. That's how physically dominant he is. And Michigan State knew how good it was to have Plaxico on their side. Now they're going to find out what it's like to guard Plaxico. That's what you're looking at in Notre Dame. And so this is going to be a tough, tough game. This is going to be a game where the Michigan State defense has to find a way, because Notre Dame isn't going to keep turning the ball over. I can't imagine. They're going to have to find a way to stop Notre Dame, and that's not easy to do. In 2 straight games, Notre Dame's dominated the ball. They've held on to the ball. They've dominated on offense. It's Notre Dame's defense that's had some issues, and Cousins is going to have to come out throwing, and his receivers are going to have to be ready to play. And this is going to be a tight ball game, and it's going to be a lot of fun. But But don't be surprised if Notre Dame comes out and scores another 40 points next week. That's all.
I can see the Spartans putting up maybe 30 and Notre Dame scoring 40 in Green. A couple more games we want to talk about here. Alabama-Penn State.
Yeah, Alabama-Penn State. Oh, I feel bad for Penn State. I mean, Penn State looked overmatched on both the offensive line and defensive line. But even though they were overmatched on the offensive line and defensive line, Alabama's offense is awful. They miss McElroy. They miss Julio Jones. And they're two big playmakers from last year. McElroy completed 71% of his passes last year. Julio Jones, you're talking about another Plaxico Burress, Charles Roger type college wide receiver. And so two dominant players. They missed them a lot. As a result, Penn State was able to hang around, but they weren't really able to do anything. Penn State can't figure out their quarterback situation. None of their quarterback, McGloin, didn't show anything. Bolden showed flashes here and there. Can't really move the ball. No one really worries about the passing threat there. They couldn't complete a deep pass. So Alabama sat on a short stuff, tough game. But Alabama 27, Penn State 11. DB, Toledo, Ohio State, game came down to the wire. You were watching it on the Big Ten Network because my cable company, RCN, sucks. DB, go ahead.
Yes. I'll tell you, Toledo, and a lot of you probably saw the score and wondered, wow, Ohio State just got by, and they did just get by. I think it was really more or less Toledo not sort of going for the kill. Toledo had a fairly decent drive going down the field, and they were very good on third downs and fourth downs going down the field on Ohio State's defense. Their defensive backs are pretty good for Ohio State, too. But that last play where it was fourth down and inside the red zone or close to the red zone in the Ohio State territory for Toledo, the last play where the quarterback sort of dropped back and it looked like there was a communication issue between him and the receiver. The ball sailed way over the head of the receiver. It looked like he came in and the ball went over his head. That was pretty bad. But, you know, Toledo had a shot there. Ohio State was short on some people. But the Buckeyes, Satchmo, I'm not sure they're kind of funny, too. I think, you know, next week we have the Scandal Bowl, Ohio State and Miami, so we'll see what happens there. I suspect Ohio State's better than Miami with all the problems they have, but, you know, we'll see. I think the Spartans are better than the Buckeyes right now, so I'm sticking with that until I see otherwise.
Yeah, it seems to be Ohio State had some trouble covering some of the Toledo receivers, and one in particular, whose name escapes me at the moment. But they had struggles there. And if it wasn't for a punt return for a touchdown, this is a different game. And Toledo got an awful good punt and called back for a penalty, and they punted again, and Ohio State ran it back for a touchdown. That's the difference in the game. Iowa State, the Hawkeyes go into Ames, and they come back limping, DB.
Yeah, Iowa State put on quite a show with my favorite quarterback name, Steele Rance, or whatever his name is. I forget his name, but that's quite a quarterback name. Iowa State did a great job. They got a big offensive line. They mixed the pass and the run really well. Iowa got a pretty good defense. That was a shootout. Good rivalry for the Cy Hawk Award, and Iowa State comes up on the short end of that quite a bit. But they won it, and so good for them.
Yeah, 44-41 is the final in overtime. And let me tell you what, DB, Michigan State played Iowa a bunch of times. Everyone knows it is hard to score on Iowa. And Iowa State did it and did it in bunches, and deserves some credit for it. We need to touch on this game just because of the – tragic is the wrong word here, but just because of the serious nature of it. Minnesota, New Mexico State, and – we've got 60 seconds left on the live stream. We're going to go a little bit over on the live stream. So if you're listening live, you're going to have to download the entire podcast at blogtalkradio.com/Spartia. And if you're just listening to the podcast you've already downloaded, keep on listening. You'll be good to go. We're just going to be running a few minutes over our normal hour show here. But there's the serious nature of this is why we're talking about it. Minnesota, New Mexico State. Game's on the line practically, and all of a sudden, the Minnesota coach Jerry Till is down on the sidelines. with a seizure, and you see the coaches sort of hold. You see the coaches holding him down, trying to get through the worst of the seizure, and he's rushed to the hospital. Scary moment there in Minnesota TV.
Yeah, well, hopefully, the last report I heard was that Jerry Kill's in stable condition at a Minneapolis hospital, and our best wishes to him.
He's in stable condition. He's got a history of seizures come as a result of his fight against kidney cancer. He was diagnosed with kidney cancer a few years back. He's cancer-free, as far as everyone knows. And they didn't take apart, but the seizures were part of it, and they're triggered by heat and dehydration. And it was a hot and humid day in Minnesota, and so we're wishing them all the best. And it came at a really odd time in the game where Minnesota was driving to tie the game, and the whole tenor of everything changed. But we wish Jerry Kill the best.
Something like that can definitely overshadow the game. And, you know, another note on Minnesota here, Satch, when I said this last week, we're picking through the Big Ten. Minnesota's going to have a tough year. They could go winless.
Yeah, they could. It is tough for them. As we go quickly clicking through the Big Ten here, Nebraska had some problems with Fresno. Fresno State, but I pulled away in the end, 42-29. Nebraska's not a world beater, folks, but they are very good, and their quarterback, Taylor Martinez, is very fast. Guy's got some quicks.
Well,
that's for
Fresno
sure.
State showed me last night, Satchmo, that, if you know, really, we talked about this too, Satchmo. Nebraska's defense is the strength of their team, and Fresno State showed me last night that if you can somehow limit Taylor Martinez and that Nebraska offense, you've got a shot. And so it'll be interesting when Nebraska goes through the Big Ten schedule.
Yeah, I think it will be interesting. And we've seen that the past few seasons from Nebraska where they get off to a quick start and then they got into the Big 12 schedule and hit a few bumps in the road. Some of them they were able to win, some of them they weren't able to win and get through, but it wasn't smooth sailing there. And so I wouldn't expect it to be smooth sailing through the Big Ten season either, but we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how Nebraska plays. I mean, the best comparison is when Penn State first came into the Big Ten. The first couple of seasons, Penn State just blitzed through the conference schedule, and then all of a sudden the Big Ten caught off to Penn State, and Penn State hasn't been the same since then. And it might be a similar thing for Nebraska. Nebraska blitzes through the conference schedule the first couple seasons, but everyone in the Big Ten raises their level of recruitment, raises their level of play, and then Nebraska becomes just another Big Ten team.
Yep.
We'll see what happens. I think it'll be interesting to see the evolution of Nebraska in the Big Ten.
There's two other Big Ten teams I wanted to mention, and I saw some of these games. Northwestern trounced Eastern Illinois, nothing unusual about that. But the one thing that's interesting is their backup quarterback, Coulter, is in for the injured Dan Persa, and he's doing a pretty good job. Northwestern doesn't look like they missed a beat, that's all.
Yeah, Pat Fitzgerald has a sneaky good team ready to play. And your Northwestern prediction, and full credit to DB here, on the Big Ten preview, on the Sparty Talk Big Ten preview, DB went out on a limb all by himself, and he said Northwestern is the team to watch this year. They could win the division. They could go to the Rose Bowl. He was out there all by himself. And you want to know what? You're starting to look pretty good here, DB. This is a very good Northwestern football team. They're doing it without Persa. Which is hard enough to do. They're playing good defense. They're getting good quarterback play. They're putting points up on the board. They haven't been threatened their games. This is a good Northwestern team that's going to give a lot of teams problems. And why can't they make the Big Ten championship game? Why can't they go to the Rose Bowl? I think you're onto something here.
Yeah, I don't see why not. I love the way Pat Fitzgerald coaches Satchmo. We like him. And the most amazing thing is that they're doing it without Persa.
Yes. Absolutely amazing. And if you think the Northwestern offense is good now, wait till they get their Heisman Trophy candidate back. I mean, that's just unbelievable.
One more squad that I wanted to touch on that I saw a little bit of, and I think this is another Big Ten team that's going to take its lumps a little bit this year, and I don't think the Spartans play them this year, is Purdue. They lost at Rice, and I think they're going to have some problems this year in West Lafayette.
Yeah, well, anytime you lose at Rice, you're going to have some problems. It's just the way it is. I mean, there's just no sugarcoat that. I mean, Rice is one of those rice to team is sort of like rice to food. It should always go down easily. And if it doesn't, you've got an issue.
Oh, so many other comments and double entendres come to my mind here at Satchmo, but I'm going to refrain.
Fair enough. All right. Let's leave the Big Ten for a little bit. And we're not even going to delve in the top 25 because really the only game of note in the time. I mean, there were some good games in the top 25. We're going to skip that because there needs to be a little bit of talk about some of the Michigan pro teams here.
Well, real quick, that's why I just want to draw attention to what I think are four pretty good games next week. One includes the Spartans and Notre Dame, obviously, that bears watching. Three other games that I think bear watching next week on a national level. You just mentioned that. Oklahoma, number one, to Florida State. I think that's a primetime game, if I'm not mistaken, on ABC. That will be fun to see. Two Big Ten games that are interesting to me next week. There might be three, but I'm drawing a blank on the one that I had in my mind. But Wisconsin is going to play Northern Illinois at Soldier Field in Chicago. I think that's an interesting game. Trap game, I think. Penn State playing at Temple. That bears some watching. And then also Iowa's taking on Pitt at home. I suspect Iowa will win, but that could be a little bit of a grudge match there on defense.
Yes, it could. I think that will be a very interesting game to take a hold of.
And then,
but DB, I don't.
And then the Scandal Bowl, Ohio State and Miami. That'll also just be intriguing, just for the intrigue of the scandals of both schools.
Yes, it will. And I'm curious as to which team has more players under suspension going into that game.
They should have a countdown clock underneath the scoreboard thing on ESPN for a number of players suspended and just a rolling ticker when they're coming back.
Yes, and because it's Ohio State and Miami, we can't rule out the possibility of more suspension. We now game day.
During the game, money exchanged in cake boxes on the sidelines.
All right, DB, I know
Vegas is going to be betting on which team gets in trouble right after the game, probably.
Brawl of the stands, more suspension.
Oh,
that, to come.
I was just thinking right there. You know, we could have a rumble on the field because the U is known for rumbling. I wouldn't be surprised to see a little trash talking rumble going on right at the right when they're coming on the field.
But could you imagine what this pregame conversation could be like between Fickell and Al Golden? I mean, they're going to walk across the field. They're like, can you believe the BS we stepped into here?
And by the way, I'm going to take a shot at ESPN here. They'll say nothing about it during the broadcast. Or even if they do, they'll pick on Ohio State.
Yeah, they'll pick on Ohio State. Here's going to be the
story. They'll say nothing about Miami.
Yeah, here's going to be the storyline. The rule breakers from Ohio State coming in to visit poor Al Golden, who's victimized by this booster, this booster, and it's not his fault. That's going to be the storyline. Just what a crock. You're right. They're not going to say anything.
Yeah.
It's going to be awful. I think I saw it on Twitter. Mike Valenti captured some of the awfulness of ESPN nicely when he noted that Mark May during the halftime show, a week after everyone was calling Al Borges the Messiah at the University of Michigan, was saying, "You want to know what? The play call is not really working at U of M. This whole process thing is not. They got to let Denard loose. They got to let Denard go out and do his thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, bring some of that rich rod offense back. And, you know, if this is after a month of calling Al Borges the Messiah, they're like, yeah, Al Borges doesn't know what he's doing. And then to a certain degree, that's a good illustration of awfulness at ESPN. But on the other hand, Mark May was right. Denard Robinson looks awful in that pro-style offense. The more they ran elements of Rich Rod's spread, the better they looked. When he was, you know, doing those zone reads and having the ball on his hip and the running back's hip and then pulling that out at the last second, that was good looking for Michigan. Well, when they're dropping straight back to pass and heaving it up there for grabs, not so much.
Yeah, they need to stop with this, you know, corralling Robinson in. If they're going to do that, they need to go to a platoon system and put Gardner in there or something else. But, hey, you know what? I'm not telling Michigan what to do. Let them screw up.
Yeah, let them screw up. Now, Davey, I know you've been looking forward to this. You want to talk a little Detroit Tigers baseball.
Yeah, well, I'll just mention this a little bit. Lots of Spartan Nation, not everybody, of course, but lots of Spartan Nation gets on the bandwagon for the Detroit teams, and the Tigers are hot right now. Once again, Satchmo, we were in the hotel in East Lansing last week, enjoying ourselves watching the football action stuff. We caught the end of the Tigers game. They're on a tear right now. The Tigers won this dramatic game in the ninth inning last week against the White Sox with two home runs to win the game. In the bottom of the ninth inning, well, lo and behold, yesterday, amid all the football that was on, the Tigers were deadlocked with Minnesota 2-2 in the bottom of the ninth inning. And Brandon Inge, who I really don't like because he's a mediocre player and somehow seems to be the spokesperson for U of M athletic department on the Tigers, comes up with his 184 average in the bottom of the ninth inning and drains a two-out solo home run to win the game. And I'm just sitting there going, wow. I mean, if this is not the Tigers' year to at least win their division, I don't know. It's going to be an epic collapse. But that was unbelievable. Go Tigers.
Yeah, and I just want to say my favorite moment of watching the Tigers game in the hotel room with UTB was when Ryan Rayburn came up the bat at the bottom of the ninth. He needed a home run to tie the game. And you spent about 30 seconds killing Ryan Rayburn. And then he cranks the home run out.
The guy just doesn't look like he should be playing. First of all, his name, Ryan. Come on. And then the second thing, I mean, he just doesn't look like a major league ball player. Plus, he makes so many errors. But every once in a while, you get somebody like that that does something like that, and you just shake your head. And then you have to believe this is your year when something like that happens and a guy like that hits a game-tying home run, right?
Absolutely. It was just fun, though, to watch you kill Rayburn and then just watch the ball leave with a look of shock on your face when that ball left the yard. It was priceless.
Hey, you should be with me at a game, because I went to a game up at Camden Yards in Baltimore here, and I was booing that guy every time he was on base. I was like, about time, Rayburn, and I was giving him the business. And other Tiger fans were looking at me like, why are you booing him? I'm like, he sucks. He shouldn't be a major league ball player. And then he does something like that. Maybe I've motivated him.
There you go. All right, and then last note on the professional sports front. The NFL season opens up. It opened up Thursday. And they got a full slate of games today. And if the NFL season opens up, that means the Hacker Football League is also open for business, which is a fantasy football league in which DB is the commish. So all of those going well. DB, any pro football predictions from you?
Wow. Well, you know, I'm not very good with pro football predictions because so many crazy things happen. But I still think Lions fans, don't hit me, but the Packers are still the best team in the NFC North. I'm going to say that. I think they didn't suffer a lot of changes. Aaron Rodgers is a heck of a quarterback. I still like Drew Brees an awful lot. We may have seen the possible NFC Championship preview on Thursday night. I don't know. You know, not discounting Philadelphia, who can make some noise. Now, in the AFC, hard to say for sure. I mean, New England's still very good. You know, you have, the Jets are an interesting team. Miami could be an interesting team. Pittsburgh and Baltimore, that's quite a fierce rivalry. Those two teams are very good. But our Detroit Lions, Satchmo, not everybody in Spartan Nation roots for them, but I'm not totally drinking the Honolulu Blue Kool-Aid here yet to say that the Lions are a playoff team. To me, a long-suffering Lions fan, if they can be 8-8 or 7-9 and approach a wild card spot or even get one, that's a good season to me, Satchmo.
Yeah, well, I'm a mere Lions observer. I am a Giants fan, and I'll get to the New York Football Giants in a moment, but I am a Lions observer, a keen observer. I used to enjoy making fun of the Lions. Now, I have to admit, I'm kind of rooting for them to do well because it's gotten boring making fun of them. Plus, I just like Ndamukong Suh. And so you can't help but root for a guy like Ndamukong Suh. He is he's a amazing talent, great attitude, like the way he plays. Look, the Lions are to me like a 500 football team. And if Stafford stays healthy, they're going to put some points on the board, but they don't have the offensive line play. They don't have the power running game they need to really get over the top. Javonte is good, but he's a concussion away from missing a lot of time. If Mikel Mascher hadn't torn up his knee, I could have seen the Lions making some noise this year.
Yeah.
But until they solidify that offensive line, I see the defense coming around.
Yeah.
I see Stafford developing some chemistry with the receivers and putting some
yeah.
points up on the board. But until they get that running game solid, it's hard to deal with a playoff team. So I'm looking forward to watching Lions. I'm looking forward to Ndamukong Suh wreck some quarterbacks. And I hope Goodell stops fighting Suh, because Suh is playing the game the way it's supposed to be played.
I'll tell you what, you know, just on the defensive side, too, that defensive line is fierce right now. When they get Nick Fairley back to full health, that defense is going to be scary. My brother pointed out the other day that Jake Cutler was already probably calling in sick for the Detroit game.
Jake Cutler feeling a touch of the flu in advance. Absolutely. But I will say this. And most people know Satchel is a Giants fan. And I just want to point out, due to injuries and bringing everything back to Michigan State, Greg Jones is going to be the starting middle linebacker for the New York Football Giants this weekend. He was a sixth-round draft pick. He went into camp just hoping to make the roster. I blocked the punt early on special teams in one of the preseason games. But he's the starting middle linebacker for the New York Football Giants, and so going to be rooting him on today. I hope he does well. Hope he gets a bunch of tackles and holds on to the spot. It's a tough way to get the job, but he's got it. Now he's got to do something with it. But good for Greg Jones. I hope he does well. And I'm going to be checking out a couple other Spartans in the league. Derek Mason. Gonna see how he does now that he's switched teams. He's with the Jets now, I believe, and so we'll see. He was with the Ravens for a long time. Always liked watching him, and so hopefully he does well there. But that's all I got. That's all I got in this end. You got any final thoughts, TV, before we wrap this up?
Well, go Spartans next week at South Bend. I don't know that it'll end in the Spartans' favor. I think that Notre Dame edges us, but. I hope that I'm wrong.
I hope you're wrong, too. Hopefully Michigan State continues its successful ways against Notre Dame. I hope we beat them in some excruciating manner, just to give Notre Dame fans a little logica. And to get us ready for the Michigan State-Notre Dame, here's the fight song to play us out. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.